One of the things that Harry talks about, and I've heard him mention this numerous times, is being rocketed into this fourth dimension. I've known two people who I think have truly been rocketed into that fourth dimension. Harry is one of them. I'm still waiting for the launch code, so I'm hoping they're coming. It doesn't work for me. I just don't have that inner peace. But you don't want to listen to me. You want to listen to Harry. So Harry, come out.
Boy, I like this carpet. It's easy to push around on it. It's all in my house. Well, my name's Harry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Harry.
But it's a little cooler here than I thought. That's just when I'm going to wear a sweater. Thank you, Rick, for what you said. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me. And let me get a little drink of water, and then I'll get started. It's good to see your faces. A lot of them that I haven't seen in a long time. Now I know where you're at. Now I can talk about you. Harry, alcoholic.
Hi.
So I'm going to start from the beginning. My experience, strength, and hope. When my first drink was at the age of 14. I did not know the difference between normal and abnormal drinking. My father drank a lot. So what I had seen as with drinking was his behavior. And when I drank for the first time, I drank until I got drunk, very intoxicated actually, to the point that I blacked out. Now, I don't think that's normal. I do remember exactly where I was when I had picked up that first drink. I was going down, I was living at the Wall, and at the time my father had a full basement of everything you can think of. At that time, my father was involved with a grocery store called IGA. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted a display of Budweiser, they would give you a couple cases. And that's how it went. So our little basement looked like a goddamn liquor store. And so it was very easy for me to have access to it. So going down the staircase, they left me with my two brothers to babysit them. And going down, there was he had this hard liquor and scotch and vodka, and I can't remember else what it was. But I grabbed the scotch, and I twisted that lid off that, and I took a chug of it, and immediately I could feel that warmth. It was like, oh, my God, what? And going down, I'm going, oh, my God, that's I've never had that with root beer soda. This is definitely, or a glass of milk, this is definitely different. So, needless to say, I got extremely intoxicated. There was a party up the street. Blacked out. The party was at there. It ended up in our house while I was babysitting my brothers. Needless to say that when my parents come home, they were quite surprised. I was passed out upstairs. And there was, at that time, there were smokers in the ashtrays. People were spilling their beer or whatever in the ashtray. So. Of course, I did not, at that age, think that my drinking was my problem, because that's the way it was. I thought you drank, you got drunk, and that's how it came down. So that continued. I'm going to say this. In that small town of Walden, New York, and I was thinking about this, I feel very fortunate that I grew up in that area because 1969, we had the concert Woodstock. That came through our town. Now, Walk Hill, New York, how many people had gone to Woodstock? The concert, not the town. Okay, so our first town, the original location for Woodstock was going to be in Walk Hill, which is 5 miles away from where I lived.
Yeah.
Okay? That didn't happen. But our little town that week was bumper to bumper. Bumper to bumper. Because they closed down the thruway. They blocked it off, so everybody was making a scramble to go around. And the reason why I'm bringing this up to you, because that area in that period of time, I knew nothing about the Vietnam War. I was 13. There was not a case of any kind of demonstration or peace. It was just a concert where my community went. There's a bunch of bands going to be there. And they went, and when they found out, the parents found out, a lot of the kids didn't have something to eat. the parents were bringing them sandwiches to the concert. You know, it was nothing, and that was it. It was nothing else for me at that age. Nothing. And obviously our town changed after Woodstock, because everybody that came back, their experience was a little bit different. I won't go into that area of that. So there was a change. It was a very, and as a musician, it was very almost like magical. I gotta say, it was a wholly different time. And my first encounter, I was playing in the band, and one of the guys, a drummer, his cousin came back from Vietnam. And I'll never forget this. He taught us how to play the blues. Us kids, how to play the blues. And we didn't even come out of that basement. I mean, the parents came down with hot dogs, and he was teaching us, and we were doing the blues, and wasn't sleeping, and staying all night, and then the next day, you know, he was teaching us the blues. Incredible guitar player. Incredible guitar player. So that was my first real experience with meeting somebody who served. And that was, the draft, I think, was ended. I got my draft card. I went to school at 70 and graduated in 74. And I don't remember when the draft card ended. When they said, was 72? Okay. So, I mean, you know, that was my experience of that era. And I have tremendous respect for the service. West Point was not that far from me. And I used to spend a lot of time at West Point. It was just something about the tradition, the atmosphere. I used to love to watch them shoot the cannon when they were taking the flag down and been to their Navy-Army games. And, you know, Navy would always kick their ass. At West Point. And, you know, it was a very interesting time. I would have served. But my turn of events was I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. Went to my first meeting in 1975. And I had my friends that had gone in and served, and I would have served if my time was time to go. Just know, let me say that very, very clearly. Yeah. So I drank. My father came in the program a year and a half prior to me, and I thought, you know, the old man needs to be in AA. You know, he's 39, I'm 19. I was 18 at the time. No, probably 17 at the time. And I thought, you know, he needs to stop drinking. His party days are over. He needs to go to the pasture. Because he's done. And I will continue on my merry way. So I didn't hang around with anybody that did not drink like I did. And I drank, and I loved to drink. Smoked a little pot. It just weirded me out. I just couldn't do it. It wasn't my bag. The drinking was my bag. I wanted to be in a guy during bars, where I can get as loaded and crapped out shit face as I possibly could. And for me, I gotta say this, at that time of my age, I just loved to drink. I love to drink. It wasn't for me, and it's just my personal opinion. It wasn't because I had problems with my family or psychological issues. I just wanted to get shit face drunk, and that was it. That was it. You know, and I could see where the problems of later staying and continually drinking, how it would brought on other issues. And in my own sobriety, I brought in some own garbage on myself, even in sobriety. So 1975, I go to my first AA meeting. We'll say that's the two of my buddies came back from, they were both on leave. They came back, they both were in the Navy, and we went on a tear, man. I mean, we went on a tear. 3-day chair. And I do remember being in a small town called Montgomery, and this was the first time that ever happened to me. The second day, I actually had to drink myself into normalcy. And I never forget, I was 19, I was shaking just to get that drink down. Just to feel normal so I can go hang with these guys and go start running. And we ran, man. I'm going to tell you, we ran. Ended up down in New York City. I don't know how the hell we got down in New York City. We're in a McDonald's. And the only reason why I knew was in the McDonald's, because I hit my head against the wall and I came out of it and I said, "Where are we?" He said, "You're in the McDonald's in New York City." I'm like, "Oh, okay." Back up to New York, upstate New York, and just partying. Getting in trouble. I don't know how we didn't get arrested, but back in those days, it was a little bit more difficult for them to track him. We were in the backwoods of New York. You start trouble. Guy had a brand. He had a 69 Camaro. We knew the back roads. You start to get in trouble, lights out. You're on the back roads and you're gone. So it was kind of hard to track him when you run like that. And by the way, he ended up becoming a state trooper for New York. Don't do that in New York, okay? It's particularly in that area. You'll catch you anyway. So that's how it went. So I thought, you know what? There's something. And I'll say this. When my father came in the program, you people were coming to the house. Now, he got rid of all the booze, which is very sad. I was very pissed off at him for a very long time, and that was part of my inventory. He got rid of all the booze. God almighty, that was sad. It was sickening. But I would come home, you know, see my father, and I'm smelling coffee and cookies, and barbecue. You're all laughing, and I'm going, Jesus, this is going to be a great party, Pop. What do you got going on here? You know, and they'd be outside playing, you know, badminton with the cops. And my father worked as a counselor at a place called Veritas Villa in the Monticello. A lot of cops at the house, man. I'm going, whoa, what'd you get yourself in here, Pops? You know, firemen and cops. And I'm talking about some tough freaking dudes, man. I would not want to mess with them. And some of them were undercover. And the guy was looked like a bum. I'm just scared the hell out of him. You know, 6 foot six, hearing his ears, you know, beard, you know. And I'm going, Jesus, what are you, priests in the house? I'm going, wow, you've changed your playmates, and these are a strange bunch. Strange, but you all are laughing and having a good time and no drinking? Okay. But I did notice one thing. I could see something in your faces that was different. Even that tall dude that was 6 foot six looked like you'd tear your head off. Had that look in his face, in his eyes, at peace, and I didn't know what I was looking at first. I had no idea what I was looking at. But I came curious. So what brought me in here was my blackouts. I continued to blackout. That third day I was in a blackout, got in a fight in some bar. Again. And I thought, this is it. I can't do this anymore. So we went back to my buddy's house. I woke up and I hurt this left leg in a fight in the gravel somewhere in one of the bars. I said, look, this is it. I can't do this anymore. I'm done. And oddly enough, that guy said to me as he was driving me home, he said, if you're an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. So a year and a half later, Tom comes in the program. Had 19 years of sobriety. He passed away when he was 35. He had to be 36, massive heart attack. He had 19 years of sobriety. What a character. They used to give him a hard time. So I come in the program in 1975. They say to me, don't drink, go to meetings. 90 meetings in 90 days, and do not open your mouth. Cotton out of your ears, you put it in your mouth. I said, okay. I picked a guy, my sponsor, his name was Kenny. He was a first class nutcase at 16 years. And actually, my first fire sponsor was a guy named Eddie. And I picked him because he was a genius. There was a board, you know, like this back here. And he was in an AA meeting like this, and he decided he was going to get up and teach everybody. So he grabbed the teaching stick. Chalk. And he started writing, this was, they started writing about sobriety and teaching everybody, and I thought, this guy's gonna be my sponsor. He's brilliant. So he was my first sponsor. He had a canary yellow Volkswagen. He had Easy Does It on one side and First Things First on the other one. And he called me up and say, you wanna go to a meeting? I'm going, okay, I'll go with you. So my first meeting was in East Paterson, New Jersey. And I never forget when I came into that meeting, I could smell coffee. Once again, I could smell laughter and hear laughter. And I thought, I'm home. I am home. I am done. I am home. and continue to go to meetings in that area. He was my sponsor for a very short period of time, by the way. And 90 meetings in 90 days was the deal. There was no reading how it works. There was no reading the traditions. There was no reading the promises. We did the serenity prayer. And I'll tell you what, the readings, the one about the serenity prayer is perfect for a marriage. Because I love to try to control my wife. You know what I mean? I want to be right in here and try to control every move she makes. And she lets me know that that ain't going to happen. So it's a great, actually it's a great way of getting myself out of the way of that particular reading that you read. It was like, that's what I need. So I go to meetings and I, 90 meetings and 90 days. Like I said, we end the Lord's Prayer, did the Lord's Prayer, and you didn't hold hands. And it was quick. We did the Lord's Prayer really quick in New York. Very fast. And you didn't want to hold the guy that's 6'6" hand that was next to you particularly. I didn't want to hold his hand. But Tom Carlo, he was trying to get around it, boy. He was a little conniving little rascal. He'd find a new girl in the program and he'd walk up to her. My father would go right up to him and say, you know what, this guy's full of shit. He's trying to 13-step you and, alright, Tom. So he'd continue with his crap. So Tom would sit there, my sponsor would sit this side, my father would sit on this side. And I believe Tom was the first one to do the volunteering with the hand. Because he didn't do that either. So Tom would raise up his hand, my father would give it in the stomach. My sponsor would pull his hand down. And he didn't even have 90 days. I mean, they were on his ass. So I learned very quickly to watch Tom Carlo to do not do what Tom Carlo is doing. Because it's going to come back. So, God bless Tom. I mean, he really tried. He was trying to bull. I know it's my story. But watching Tom was very important for me. But he would try to bull these cops, these New York City cops, and they're looking at him and they're going, I'll never forget this one cop said, and he said, Tom, he got right in Tom's face. He says, if I catch you drunk, I'm going to punch your lights out. Just like that. I mean, and Tom went, totally shut up. And I thought, you know what? I don't think I'm going to try to bullshit that cop either. You know, I mean, these guys are New York City cops. Sober. And they're not going to put up with any crap. And Tom was trying it, and it just was not getting over. So I stay in New York for a year. First step, we admitted we're power sober alcohol, and our lives become unmanageable. I knew I was definitely power sober alcohol. There was no, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to see that every time I drank, I was blacking out and couldn't stop on the first drink. It was not in my vocabulary. It didn't make any sense. Why a drink? Please. My first wife, I watched her drink a daiquiri and watch the ice melt in the glass. I'm going, why are you letting the ice melt in that daiquiri? I watched it very carefully. She said, because it changed the taste. And I walked. You need to see a shrink because there's something wrong with you. I don't get that one. I'd have 7 Cokes before she finished that daiquiri. You know, she was normal. And she was normal up here too. I hate to say that. For me, I'm a little bit of a psycho. And I would hang on to something for 3 days and spit it out to her. And she'd look at me like, what in the hell is your problem? What are you talking about? So I go, okay, I get it. I'm the nut here. She's the normie. I'm the nut. I get it. Thank you. So, so I come into program. I kind of get a little tracked. Sorry about that. So not, 90 means 90 days. I look at the third step. I'm saying, oh my God, the word God is in there. And I know there's priests in the program here with me. I don't get why they're here. What's their deal? Why is the priest sitting next to me with the cop and the rest of them went, You know, the word God, it just was, I couldn't get it. I couldn't even say the word God. So I went to a lot of meetings and back in those days, this group would pick, they'd have a session with this group. If you wanted to speak at the Howe Place, we would take 3 or 4 guys and go down to Howe Place. Howe Place would take 3 or 4 guys and come up here and speak. So I would be in the car with these guys. We'd go to Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, and speak. And I'll say, you know, what about that word God? I'm really having a hard time with that. And they say, Jesus, don't worry about it. Just don't drink, kid. It's G-O-D, good orderly direction. Don't worry about it. Just hang in there. It's going to be okay. And smile at me. And said, okay. So I stayed up there in New York for about a year, and I decided that the weather was a little too much for me. I had the opportunity to move to Georgia, and that's what I did. I came down here. I moved to Georgia. I can't tell you when I changed my idea about the word God, but it did happen. And I won't talk a lot more about my experience as far as my drinking, because a lot has been, it's been 44 years. It's been 44 years since my last drink. It's been a lot of living going on in 44 years. A lot of experience. Life experiences. Just because I have come into program and sobered up does not mean that life is still, for me, does not still going to come at me. It's still going to come at me. But the great news is don't have to drink. The old saying that the cash register doesn't ring, that Harry O'Brien rings up, clean, that Harry has to pick up a drink. That there's a way out. And I'm saying good or bad, because I've had some very, very successful things happen in my life. So it does not mean only the bad, it's also the good in my life. I think the good sometimes can throw me off just as fast as something. I think because something tragic happens, it kind of wakes me up like, holy crap, I really need you people. You know, but when things are going great, it's like, you know, I don't need to go to as many meetings. You know, I don't have to crack that big book as much as I think I do, you know. So I came down to New York, and because of the cold weather, I couldn't take the cold weather anymore. It was ridiculous. And went to my first meeting in Rebo's, the old Rebo's Club. And it was a tough bunch of birds down there, that old Rebo's meeting, man. I never forget that old clubhouse. When I came in that old clubhouse, way in the back was this huge white chair. And God bless his soul, Lynn Blake, I'll say his last name, he's passed away, he used to sit in that, they made it for him because he was a huge guy. Ex-military, I mean, just a first-class nut. Would sit down, he had laughed at you to look like, whoa, Lynn, hey, hang in there, pal. And, but just an incredible janitor. And that was his chair, because that's the only chair would fit Lynn. And, that was just a bunch of old timers down there, a lot of smoke in this old building that we're in. And, old Mavis, I'll never forget Mavis, boy, she was a character. She'd lay you out in 2 seconds, right in the meeting, man. Talking about crosstalk? This woman would crosstalk and lay you out. You cheat, you were full of crap, she'd tell you. Flat out. You are full of H. And then, you know, you'd be like, oh, I think I'll keep my mouth shut. She was tough bird, man. And then, oh God, I can't remember the other old timers, a couple old timers. This one, she was a tough nurse, World War II nurse. The way she came back into the country was in a parachute. You know, she jumped out of a plane to get back into the States. You know what I mean? Just tough. Didn't want to mess with her. I mean, she was quite a character. And I went to Rebo's, was my first meeting. Then ended up becoming my home group, Swingers meeting. Went to Biscayne Room and went to a lot of meetings here in Atlanta. Obviously, it was a little different than New York. But I had to come to understand that I'm here, I need to stay sober, and I need to do the things in order to do that. And one of the things that I was told is you get your home group, you get involved. That's what I did. And get your sponsor. And they got me a new sponsor here in Atlanta. I picked Pat W. Pat was my sponsor. And I picked Bill Roop. And I'll say both their names because, well, you're taping me, aren't you? I just added that. Because you all know exactly what I'm talking about, all right? All right, so don't tell anybody. Don't edit it. Edit. Quick cut. So I picked Pat because Pat was just like, he'd tell you stories. I'm having a tough day, Pat. He was just on and talking. He was great about old stories. You know, and then he laid out. Tony, both these guys were all from Chicago, and Tony D, he'd lay you out in a second. You know what I mean? I needed somebody that's, you know, well, okay, I get it. I'm out there. But Bill was kind of this very soft. He would give it to you, and about 3 weeks later, you go, did he tell me off? I think he told me off. So it was, you know, quite an interesting crew of guys that I met and got involved with. And so I came down and I met this drummer. I stopped playing music because I thought music was part of the problem. So I come down here and I meet this. My father comes down from the room. I'm not even tracking time, so people, let me keep you preoccupied. Let me know the time, please. So my father comes down from New York, and I was working for Big Star Foods, which was IGA. I was working for them. And I had a real good job, but I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. And my father comes down here. I was going to impress him. You know, I had bought land in Dawsonville. It's worth a goddamn fortune now. I wish I still had it, but anyway. And I had a good job. I had an apartment. I had multiple accounts. And I was going to impress him, and he comes, we go out to eat, and he looks at me and he goes, because I was doing shows with my father. My father was also a comedian. So I was in the band, my father was doing the shows. So he looks at me and he goes, you know what, Harry? You're so goddamn responsible, you make me want to throw up. He says, what are you doing? You love playing music. Go back to playing music. So that's exactly what I did. And thank God I took his advice. I hooked up with this drummer named Bob B. Very famous drummer, but a first class psycho. He had done the tours with a very wild band. So I meet Bob and he says to me, are you a bass player? I said, yes, I play bass. He looked at me and went, yeah, right. Because I had short hair. I mean, Bob had this goddamn hair. I mean, he looked like, wow, man. He just got off the road with his drums. So he just actually just got out of the psych ward. And, which is true. Because drummers have, any drummers in here, just don't take it personal, but you guys are a little nuts. I think it has something to do with banging on the skins. I'm not really sure. Every drummer I met was the exact same way. Wild and crazy. So Bob, I meet Bob and he says, let's put a band together. So we put a band together, start traveling with Bob. Had a great time, man. And we went to meetings. I made sure we got to meetings in the towns that we went in. And every time we get a new member of the band, Bob would just love to work him over in his own little, you know, because when you get a new member in any situation, you got to get him acquainted in a very interesting way. And so we do a lot of traveling. I'll never forget this day. I was driving this big international Lodestar with all of our equipment in it, and he's sitting next to me. I'm driving. We got the CB, and we're having a great time, and we're heading to Daytona Beach, Florida, to play. And Bob's on medication. He says, "You know what? I am done with my medication because he had psych problems. That's it." And he throws it out the window. And I'm driving this massive truck. And you guys, truck drivers, you just don't stop the truck to pull over to get somebody's med. It's just not that easy. Because you got a full load, big truck, and you got to gear that. And I'm like, holy crap. Holy crap. So, about a month or two later, I'm playing in Charleston, South Carolina. I go get on the dance floor while we're playing, and I hear the drums stop. And I look around, and I see Bob leaving the club, a packed club. And everybody's looking around going like, what the hell is going on? Well, Bob decides that he's going to go walk home. From Charleston. The only way I can get him back inside is I send a female out to go get him. And we get him back in, and we have to get him into the hospital. What does that have to do with my sobriety? Is this. If you take medication, if you are in sobriety, and this is just my personal opinion, please, I am not a doctor. Don't ask me if you should or should not. That is not my role. I am your sponsor. And it's about alcoholism and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not need to interrupt or give you opinion either or us. Because I've seen what happens when you don't. Firsthand. Poor Bob, we get him in the hospital, and I think if poor Bob flipped out, we're never going to see Bob again. Guess what he's doing? He's playing pool. Hey, Harry, how's it going? Bob Burns is back on his medication. Oh, I just said his last name. Sorry about that. So, what has Bob Burns taught me? That life is too goddamn short, and I'm going to tell you something. I had a great time. in sobriety, sober, playing for a living. I realized I had been given the brass ring, the opportunity. And I've met some tremendous people in AA on the road. Tremendous. I've met some great people. I'll tell you one story, and I'll tell you. I met this woman. We were playing in Corinth, Mississippi. And somebody says this woman needs to be picked up. Take her to a meeting. I said, don't you, anybody around here in Mississippi have a car? I'm out of town. I got to go get her. I got to play at 9 o'clock, and I got to go get this lady. All right, I'll go get her. So they give me directions, and I go and I pick her up. And she's got walkers. This is 78, an older woman. And she's coming to the car, and I'm going, my God, is she ever going to get to the car? He opens the gate, she gets in the car, and there's just this crusty old woman. I'm going, oh boy, here we go. So we go to a meeting, we're heading to the meeting. And I said to her, what happened? Why do you got walkers? Now I'm on my feet. This is before my accident. She's a nurse. Got trapped in the Philippines. Behind enemy lines, prisoner of war. They snapped both of her legs. Snapped both of her legs. Because she knew martial arts. And I thought to myself, selfish son of a bitch. Here's this woman that's been through shit, and you're acting like an asshole. You never know who you're going to meet. Never know. And what she does is she goes to prisons as her service and talks to the women, brings them meetings. I'm talking about one crusty old woman, but solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you never know. And I'm very, very fortunate that I've met so many people in my life that have touched my life, and it would have never have happened if I didn't stay sober. Through this spiritual experience, this God of my understanding, who I refuse to initially understand or accept, was loving enough to keep this jerk, this soul, sober long enough to wake up to the fact that there is a loving creator that is beyond my understanding, but I have sensed its power that has kept me sober and moving me forward. So in 1983, I stopped to help somebody on the side of the road, coming out of the Rebos. I ended up paralyzed on my back on fire in a creek. Now, the reason why I'm saying this to you is because that event was another awakening for me. Spiritual awakening. The internal dialogue had stopped. That construct of what I thought I was, all that thinking, laying in that ditch, stopped abruptly. I was 100% in presence to this power. The only thing between me and it was my breath. And I always said that I was dying. But actually, what had gotten me was life. Because at that moment, it changed for me drastically. Now, I had moments, obviously, when I first sobered up. And I'm going to say this to you. If you're sitting here today as a sober member, you have had the experience as well. But I had it at that moment intense enough. See, because I had that shift in consciousness when I sobered up. And I knew that I eventually became more aware of this presence, of this power, through you people. But at that moment, it had me. And I felt love and I felt peace. I was 28 years old. I could have gone right then and there. It would have not have mattered one iota. It was no fear. It was just exactly peace and something like had grabbed a hold of me. Like I was being put in the cocoon. The only thing I can think of after that only, was my family. Because I knew I was going to be okay. But how were they going to take it? And that next thing that came was a guy came down, jumped in that hole with me, and started asking me my name, and I ended up first in Ridgeview, Smyrna Hospital, taking off my clothes, cutting my clothes off because I was a mess. Then they took me to Northside Emergency. I was in intensive care, and that power, that presence is still with me. It's not as strong as it was when I first. Obviously, I wish I could stay in that bliss and in that kind of love all the time, but unfortunately, I get right smack in the way again. But that's okay. That's okay. So my search for that has been ongoing. What was that happened? How did that happen? And I will say this, that Logan is sitting in the back, and he gave me a book by Deepak Chopra that catapulted me into the fourth dimension. I was already in the rocket, like Lynn said. But that moved me quickly into the next phase, because I was afraid to look anything about meditation and all that. I mean, I'm a Catholic. I am a Roman Catholic. So let me get that straight. I am a Roman Catholic, not just a Catholic. So anyway, I started searching. Because meditation was not, I didn't think, well, meditation, me. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. For me, it includes meditation and prayer and inventory. And understanding that my biggest problem is my way I perceive. My primary problem is not the situation of unhappiness. It's how I perceive, or how I think about the situation has been my problem. So the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a very, very slow slicing of love, of that ego. Of love. It's just a slow slicing of the fear and the ego and the anger, because I came in here very angry, and it's slow moving me closer to this relationship with this God and this presence, which I choose to call God today. For me, it is a word, because I believe, and I'm just going to say this is my personal opinion, is that beyond any words or anything that's going to come out of my mouth, it's not going to happen. So I start seeking out, what time do I got, Ryan? How am I doing? Am I okay? So I start seeking out these masters. Alright, if I want to learn how to work on a car, I'll seek out some master, pneumatic master mechanic. So I start seeking out the meditation masters, which are Tibetan monks. Alright, I think they got a handle on that, I don't know. If you're going to hang out in a cave for a year and meditate, you're either very nervy nuts or you're on hard drugs, or you're doing something that's changing your life. So, just kidding about that. So I meet these monks. Afraid of them, to be honest with you. Because I believe they probably could see right through my ass. Not knowing that they don't give a shit one way or the other. Maybe they could care less. So, I've watched them a couple of times, more than once. You know how we are. I'm watching for someone to make a mistake. I want them more to say, like, the building of Mandela, and one of them go, I won't use the word, but I'll say it in a kind way. So they're building the Mandela, and they make a mistake. I'm waiting for one of them to say, well, God, I can't believe it. Gotcha. You ain't really what you're saying you are, huh? Never happens. So I go there the third time, and I'm talking, and now watch this old monk. I mean, he's always bent over. He's in this red thing. And well, so I'm looking at him, and he's coming my way. He's probably about 80, maybe 90. He's coming at me, and I, at the reverence, bow. And he comes up, and he slams his head right here against my head. He walks up, and just boom, butts me right in my head. I'm going, what? What the heck was just that? And he walks away laughing. And we're going, okay. So next day I go there and I'm talking to some people, and all of a sudden in the corner of my eye I see this old monk. He's headed straight for me. And I turn to look at him, and I bow, and guess what he does? He cracks me with his head right here against my head. So loud that the two people that were standing next to me said, good God, I heard that from here. And what does he do? He's laughing. He's walking away. I'm going, what the heck is this? What the heck? What the heck is going on here? So they have a meeting. So they meet at the meeting with the monks, and they, you know, I get invited, and I'm listening, and I'm watching this old monk. He can't speak English. And I asked one that could speak English, why did he crack me in the head like that? I already knew why now. Every time I think about it, I laugh. I knew why now. Because every time I think of him and I think of that situation, I laugh my ass off. Because that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to snap me out of it. He said, well, that's a very special gift for you. You know, if I was drinking, I'd still be in a bar in upstate New York, man. Buddhist monk, are you freaking kidding me? You need a couple more drinks, pal, because you don't need to be around me. Because you're just, I don't know what your deal is. So you see what this program has done for me. It's opened me up to things that I thought I would never, and people that I've never experienced. And all of you that are sitting here, all of you that are sitting here with me, you've changed my life. You've taught me how, what is right, what is wrong, if I'm willing to listen and take a look. It's given me the opportunity to allow good things to happen in my life, and to realizing that what I'm thinking is not accurate. Just because I'm thinking it doesn't mean it's really true. It's present moment awareness for me today, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the continuation of these 12 steps, continue to take a personal inventory. It doesn't mean after I've done my initial inventory that I'm not still going to be having problems. Sometimes I have to take a spot check inventory. Could sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. It says improve conscious contact. I'm just going to speak for Harry O'Brien. Conscious contact for me is right now, gang. Not next week. Not next year. Conscious contact. What is the condition of my heart doing? Am I here? Am I practicing hatred? Am I practicing love? Here, now, conscious, contact. Stay awake. Because I can also get addicted to what I think. Because it becomes very subtle. It's become very subtle for me. I have addiction to alcohol, no doubt about it. But I also have addiction to what's going on up here. And it's very subtle. It's very subtle. It's very subtle. It is cunning. It is baffling. It's powerful just as much as the alcohol. It moves very subtly. Oh, I don't need to go to a meeting. Oh, I don't need to be doing this. And before you know it, I'm slipping away. I'm not saying that I constantly stay present all the time. No. I still get hooked. But the good news is that I have freedom. And I have peace of mind. I don't need to suffer. I bring the suffering to myself. Now, life is painful. They can't deny that fact, right, gang? But is the suffering for me is optional. Do I choose to suffer sometimes? Yeah, I kind of like to be. For whatever crazy reason, sometimes I feel comfortable in that state. In that state. Until I realize that I am burning my ass off big time. And I'll let go. Emotional sobriety. When the pain gets too much, I will let it go. I will let it go. And I will try something different. Hopefully something that is less painful, you know. So I will say this to you and then I will stop. My message for you for today is to continue to grow. Stay awake. Continue to practice. Be of service. Give yourself a break. It is really worth it. Life has been sent me some zingers, man, and I'll tell you. You know, I ended up being in this wheelchair for since 36 years, and I'll say this, and I said this to Rick, when I woke up this morning, it was raining. I was in Shepherd this month. My accident was on October the 3rd. This day, in Shepherd, They found I had a blood clot in my left leg. It had swelled up like a goddamn balloon. They had me down. They wouldn't let me sit up. And they wheeled me in a room with a bunch of other people that were in wheelchairs. And I thought, I don't belong here with these people. I am not one of these people. So you think denial is only, do we have denial? I only have denial with my drinking?
Mm-mm.
I said, these people are where I don't need to be here. So when it was raining this morning, I thought for a second, you know what, Harry? You got the opportunity to get out in that rain and go share with folks and be with your kind of people. You have that choice today. So if I get rained on, hooly hooly for you, pal. You know what I mean? Because you could be laying in the hospital in your back and not going nowhere. And it's happening right now. There's people right now that I will guarantee you wish they could be somewhere else besides laying in a bed, hurting, suffering, and unable to have that choice. So I'll say this to you, when you lay tonight, leave tonight, get a little wet. You smile at it, because it's your choice. You have that opportunity. You've had that opportunity because you're sober. So with that, I'll close. Thank you very much.
Yeah,